We're finding the book of Ecclesiastes a challenging book. All books of the Bible are challenging. They all, in a sense, convict us and at the same time show us the right way, empower us in the right way. So there's no book we turn to in the Bible that doesn't challenge where we are and lead us on to better things. But Ecclesiastes adds to that a very challenging manner of expression. This is a believing man. He tells us he's a descendant of David, a king of Israel. He could be Solomon, probably was Solomon, but he designates himself the preacher. And he says things that strike us with confusion, initially, more than perhaps any other place in the Bible. We're wondering, what is this? Is he serious? Is it true? Is it false, what he's saying? That it doesn't matter whether you live a wise life or a foolish life, since death is the great leveler? Oh, it's vanity. Life is vanity. But we have been struggling to understand, and we are, I think, seeing that we have to be very careful how we take what the preacher says in these verses. But then, when we think about our own lives, having to be careful with these words and how we take them, and more than anything else, they demand that we seek understanding and work for understanding to understand them correctly. That's how we should live our lives. He speaks words of truth and words that are false at the same time. And it's not that they're mixed together and the truth is ruined by what's false. This is what God would have taught Adam and Eve had they not taken the forbidden fruit. Good and evil. Good in distinction from evil. And this is what the preacher is speaking about. Seeing the world sometimes from a perspective of faith and sometimes not. And sometimes with faith that's clouded by no faith. Like the man who said to Jesus, "I do believe, but help my unbelief." So when we go to study these words, we have to bear that in mind. That has to be our operating principle. We're not to expect pure truth in anything, Solomon says. We're not to expect pure falsehood, but both together and sort them out. And why should we learn to live this way? Because you and I never in our lives have spoken pure truth. We're not capable of speaking pure truth because we don't know what pure truth is. We see things partly. Then, when we're perfected in glory, we'll see entirely. We know now in part. Then we'll know entirely and be known perfectly. So meanwhile, what we are being challenged to do is get off our high horse of assumptions that we're right and everybody else around us is wrong. Stop judging, as Jesus says. Don't judge. We're not competent judges of others. What are we commanded by God to do in the great commandment? Judge others? We're commanded to love others. And if you're going to love the real person, that demands a humility and an openness and a hunger to understand who they are. And every one of us is riddled with wretchedness as well as covered by righteousness. So, this is a good thing to be going through in the exercise of our souls. Last week we considered in verses 1 to 9 of chapter 5 something about worship and its connection with civil government. And of course, we found worship full of all sorts of undesirable things, hypocrisy and so forth. We saw worship attended to by people who were careless, but acting like they were careful and reverent in the worship of God. And he says, and rightly deplores that. We saw people who were impulsive and wordy, windy and empty in their prayers, praying lots of nice words, but not with any understanding or commitment. And finally, making and breaking vows easily. This is a very negative view of the church, isn't it? But it's a true one. It's a true one. If we break our vow once, we've done it too many times. And we all have broken a vow. If we have spoken a hasty word once in prayer, it's too many times. And we've all spoken mindlessly to God many times. The root of the problem, of course, is that there's no fear of God. Fearing God leads to proper worship and seeing the higher hand of God in the church. It's not just people coming, and it's not just people singing the songs that they choose to sing and reading in the book and making of the book what they will. It's not just that. There's God. God is in the situation. And he's to be dealt with reverently, not casually. And if we see him in our worship, we go out and find he doesn't live in this building. He's out in the world. He's in our lives. He's in our homes. He's in our minds and our hearts. And so we make of ourselves better citizens because we worship God with reverence. Godly reverence also leads to a hunger for more than mere material things. And that leads us on to our passage for this morning, where economic considerations come into view. Now, the wisdom literature in the Bible, which this is part of, but I'm referring especially to Proverbs, has a fair amount to say about good economy, how to make and keep a budget, how to run a household well. And it speaks about running nations well, too. So this is something that is important, and the Bible has something to say about it. But again, the preacher is bringing his perspective to bear, and it's a valid perspective. It's one, to some extent, that we all need to understand, because what he's doing, he's showing the limitations of even the good gifts of God's common grace when we don't have faith. So he starts by dealing with the uncertainty and emptiness of riches. Now, most people wouldn't think that money is a bad thing. Most people would say, if you offered him $1 million, I thanks. Is it stolen? I don't want to go to jail, but if it's not and you really want to give it, thank you. And as Christians, we assume, don't we? It's better in my hands than in some unbelievers' hands. You know, they're wasted on sinful endeavors. But I can give to Christian works. And that, you know, that may or may not be true. Most of the rich people I know, and I do know some who don't do this. I do know some. They've been gone. They're up in heaven now. But while giving away a lot, they manage to hang on to a lot too. That's okay. That's okay. Because it's not the possession of money that this is all about, whether you possess a lot or a little. It's the love of money. The love of money. As Paul writes to Timothy, the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. Now, Abraham was rich. David was rich. Paul may have been rich. He was an esteemed Pharisee, and they liked their money, even though they tried to pretend like they were pious. Paul may have been rich, and maybe he wasn't rich. But Paul certainly had no love for money after he encountered Christ on Damascus Road. And he testifies to that in Acts chapter 20 when he speaks about his ministry amongst the Ephesians and says, I didn't covet anybody's money or didn't take anything. I worked with my own hands and so forth. And this begot in him not impoverishment, but contentment and blessedness. When you don't love money, you view it as a tool. You don't need a gigantic backhoe to pot a single rose in a pot. You just don't need it. You use the right tool for the job. So nobody needs a ton of money, a lot of money. We're not taught by God to pray for that. We're taught to pray for our daily bread, which is to say, as our confession tells us, a competent portion of this world's goods, meaning that which we can use competently, rightly, wisely, effectively, and it not ruin the lives of ourselves and others by abusing it and idolizing it. That's what Paul's talking about here, the blessedness of when he's speaking about his respecting the limitations of money. He says, as he writes to the Philippians, "I've learned to be content with Christ. I can do all things." But again, Paul may or may not have had money. It's one thing to tell a poor man to be content. Okay, I'll try that. I can't make any money. I'm not educated enough or whatever the reason. So I'm never going to have any money. I may as well try to find contentment with what I've got. This is what the rich tell the poor through the history of the world. This is what the rich in colonial and thrown in Christian endeavor, because they were little paragraphs in all the early charters to come to this continent, that the holy Christian religion be spread. Strange way to spread it, decimating the indigenous people, but never mind that. This imperial impulse is in all of us. And if you don't have the money, but you're resenting it because of that impulse, and told by those who do have money, and especially Christians when they have money, there are entitled Christians, all of us. All of us here are entitled. No, there's no poor people here that I see. We say, well, just be content. Be content. I'm cold. I'm hungry. Just go and be content. I'll pray for you. The Bible condemns that kind of religion. So, why do we so easily love the money? Because it seems to be. We know that it's not good to eat. It's not really a good tool. You can't jack your car up with a wad of $100 bills. Why do we love it? Well, because it's a means of exchange of goods and services. And when we've got it, nobody is going to tell us how to spend it. We spend it how we want. Nobody goes into this 7-Eleven and the guy say, are you sure that you are worthy of that quart of milk you're trying to buy? Don't put your money down here unless you pass this moral test. Doesn't work that way. Money, milk, deal's done. So we think it's a way that facilitates the life that we want to live. And we tell ourselves that as Christians, you know, we're going to live it okay. We're going to stay within the bounds and be good stewards and all that. But what we really want is the money, 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 money. More money, not less money. Paul may not have had money. Solomon did. And he speaks from experience as a man who loved money and found it a cursed disease. And he is sharing this treasure with us to save us from going through the bitter experience of making an idol out of money. That's all I have to say about that, because a word to the wise is sufficient, but to a fool, many words won't add up to anything. He goes on to speak about the many pangs. And there are seven of them, and that number seven is significant. It's a number for perfection. He's telling us money and the love of money is perfectly cursed. If you love money, you ruin your own money, and it ruins you. It has power to do that. Now, again, not possession. And truly wise and truly loving and pious use of one's resources, but loving the money. Many pangs. That's why we shouldn't love it. In verse 10, it's inability of things that it procures to satisfy. The heart set on riches is set aflame with desire and set craving with a hunger which nothing can satisfy. I want that new car. I want that new phone. I want that new television. The high definition, the curves. I want that. And then they come out with something better. What happens? I want that. And it just keeps going on. It doesn't satisfy. The love of money doesn't satisfy. It digs an appetite within us that's bottomless. Secondly, verse 11, riches multiply consumers and dependent caretakers of the wealthy. What rich person does his own taxes? He'd be a fool to even try. Because, you know, I can do my taxes. Mine are more complex than yours are because I'm a pastor and I've got all sorts of little loopholes and provisions in the tax code for a pastor, at least for now. But, you know, if you don't make enough money to do anything other than file the 1040 and maybe a Schedule A and so forth, you could do your own taxes and save money. You don't have to pay an accountant. But what person with money could possibly do that? He'd be a fool. She would miss so many things, so many ways that you could save money on your taxes. But what do? To do that, you have to pay the accountant. And you pay them according to the number of schedules. And they seem to find 10,000 schedules. The next thing you know, you're thinking, did I really save money? But who knows? And I don't have the time to spend doing that. So I pay that. And of course, then everybody's suing you. They want to get your money. They come up with frivolous lawsuits. And usually you just have to buy them off. You know, settle. Just settle. It happens. It happens to people who are known to be wealthy. That's what this is talking about. Muhammad Ali died a poor man, not because he didn't have money. He had millions and tens of millions of dollars, but he had so many people hanging on him and depending upon him. They sucked him dry. A rich man's gardener, we're told, can enjoy the man's gardens as much as the man can, oftentimes more than the man can, because the gardener is doing the work and seeing the results of the labor of his hands. But the rich man can only look on and say, this is mine, this is my garden, and dread losing it. So, riches bring their own troubles. Thirdly, verse 12, riches rob one of rest. Not only do they not allow contentment, but contentment is a prerequisite to true rest. You can't rest when you know your job's undone. You can't rest when you think the door's open, the door to the house is open. You can't rest when you think, I need to be vigilant. Did I turn the alarm on? If you have alarm in your house, did I turn the alarm on? We've all experienced this. Oh, you're in the grocery store. Did I lock the car? You can't rest. You have to be contented to enter into rest. And the trick is, it's not just you can make it up. It's like I will now feel contented. It's based on something else. It's based on knowing that you're secure. And then that gets to the question of, where is your security? Is it in your money? So this is what's drawn out in verse 12. The working man can sleep after a day's honest labor, even if he is so too poor to buy much to eat. This is where sleep is a blessing. My mother used to say we had 6 kids. That was considered a lot in those days. And we all were hungry as anything. And we'd run out of food sometimes. We're hungry, Mom. Well, go to bed, honey. You won't be hungry then. And it worked. So this is what he's saying. The man who loves riches drives ever to have more riches and fears losing what he's already got. It's not enough, though. It's not enough. I'm not securing it. I've got to drive to get more, but I'm afraid to lose even what I've got. This makes wise investing a losing proposition for a person. A person who rightly understands the true value of money and the true power of money can be a wise investor. because you know I can do without this, and I know that it's exposed to a reasonable amount of risk in order to get a higher degree of reward. But I know it's safe. I've done all my homework and I've investigated, and it's reasonably safe. But if you love money and are afraid to even potentially lose it, you don't invest. And you sit like the one talent man and make nothing of the tools God has given you. The man fears ever their loss. So cares, anxieties, projects to get more money fill his mind day and night. Fourthly, verse 13, money lovers hoard money and are hurt thereby. You remember when the Lord told the people of Israel on the Sabbath day, go and get the manna when they were in the wilderness. Go and get the manna every day, except the day before the Sabbath. Get a double portion. Don't go out on the Sabbath day. And don't try and keep it for after the Sabbath day. You know, consume what you have on the Sabbath day. Don't try and save the manna. Well, that was demonstrating something like money. It's the blessing of the Lord that makes rich, the Proverbs tell us, and he adds no sorrow to it. It's the blessing of the Lord that provided for and prescribed the gathering of the manna, but when Israel violated that, they were grieved in the result. The manna bred worms, and a man going out to gather sticks was stoned, needing a stick to cook his meal or something. Money lovers hoarding money hurt themselves. Not only do they miss the blessing of giving, and Jesus said it is more blessed to give, and those who have money are inclined to say, it is, so you people should be giving more. But not me. They not only miss the blessing of giving, and it is more blessed to give, but they're corrupted by the riches they hoard. The money is eating holes, literally, in them. James in James 5, the opening verses of that chapter, speak about it rusting and corrupting and corroding and eating away at the person. Just hanging on to money. But it's not the money, it's the love of money. That's the power that's doing that. Fifthly, verse 14, riches are perishing. And they seem to perish at the worst time. The man is driving himself nuts, working and accumulating money when he has no dependents, and then he's wisely investing or he's saving in it in a certain place, and now there's a child on the way, he's got a dependent. It all goes at the worst time, when others near to him are most dependent upon his material provision. Better to trust in the Lord. Work diligently and wisely in the light of the Lord, and to provide that as the inheritance of our children, that would make them wise and them diligent to go out and make money, to go out and earn a living, instead of inherit a fortune and take it easy. Sixthly, riches do not endure beyond the grave. Again, death is the great leveler. Riches do not endure beyond the grave. And then seventhly, verse 17, riches are idols casting the soul throughout life into bondage and bitterness. Riches, when idolized, cast us into bondage and bitterness. It becomes an addiction. Got to have more of it. And it's never enough. Never enough. That was the rich fool. More, 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 more. Oh, now my problem is, where do I put it? I'll build bigger barns. Now I'm okay. You fool. This night your soul is required of you. Seven things that he says that tell us that riches are perishing and inadequate. I didn't go into great detail with any of them. I just summarized them because I'm telling you to go into the detail. Go back and read. What is true about this? It's true to this extent, but then it's false beyond this extent. And there's profit more than with money to be had from our doing that. But then common grace does come in verses 18 to 20. The work to which we devote ourselves to sustain life is what we're called to do. Work to sustain life. Thorns and thistles the world has now. The earth doesn't yield its treasures the way it did when it was paradise before God subjected it to vanity. You must, by the sweat of your brow, earn your bread. Even in the New Testament, for those in Christ, if they're not working, Paul says, let them not eat. Let them not eat. They can work. And if they don't know how, teach them how. To work and to sustain one's life and find enjoyment. That's it. But even this, while it's acknowledged by the apprehension of common grace to be a gift of God, even this is as a gift of God can be misconstrued as though that's all there is to it, and it's not. Yes, we should find contentment in the little things and in the common grace of God. It's still, just because it falls on the just and the unjust, it's not ruined to us thereby. So we should enjoy the common gift of grace of labor and the Lord allowing it to be productive when we do it rightly. In verse 19, it's good to enjoy the abundance when God gives it. God, we said that Abraham was rich, David was rich. It wasn't his riches that spoiled him. It was looking where he shouldn't have, when he shouldn't have. To enjoy the abundance when God given and using riches responsibly. This is what he goes on to say when every man does this. And this keeping riches in their proper place distracts a man from the cares and sustains him with gladness. Verse 20, he will not often consider the years of his life. You're working and you're working. This is why a lot of people work and say, I never want to retire. And that isn't necessarily a bad thing to retire or not to retire. But this is what happens. This is what can happen. I got to keep working because I would never think of stopping because I'm just enjoying what I'm doing so much. And that's a gift of God. God is keeping us occupied. And the other part of that is that God is giving that to us as a gift and we're not, we're going to sink. We're going to sink into misery and anxiety and so forth. So all of that. So, this keeping riches in their proper place distracts a man from his cares and gives him gladness. But do many people keep riches in their proper place, even though it is? The principles of good economy are not derived entirely from the Bible. People have discovered them, just like gold. Gold wasn't discovered in the Bible. It's spoken of in the Bible. Men and women have always discovered things that God has put in this one earth upon which we all live. And the principles of good economy are one of those things. It's a gift of God's common grace that it works that way. But then how many do? How many do respect it? But certainly not for the believer. When we do not exercise faith, things don't go well with us. Therefore, the return to considering the vanity of covetousness in chapter 6. The many who slide from keeping a competent portion, using it wisely and so forth, and having some gladness of heart in life. Of course, he's already said, well, death is there lurking, and that's going to ruin it all, but at least for the time being in life, you'll be happy. Now we come back to considering covetousness in chapter 6. Now, the love of money is the addiction and idolatrous apprehension of what material things we have, what things we have. Covetousness is the desire, the excessive desire, the evil desire to have what we don't have. So we're covering all the bases here through the preacher. We can covet money as well as many other things. And so really the scope widens now. There are godless people who really don't care much for money. But for them, not all of them, but some of them, it feeds their pride and their arrogance and their vanity. I don't worship material things. That's even worse, isn't it? Because that's a form of self-worship. Many who slide from this go on to lose their wealth. Verses 1 and 2 in chapter 6. I've seen this evil which is under the sun, and it's prevalent among men. Prevalent. Most do. Even though we can, everybody, you don't have to be a believer, everybody can live a life of economic success. That the man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor so that his soul lacks nothing of all that he desires, but God has not empowered him to eat from them, for a foreigner enjoys them. This is vanity and a sore affliction. This is what Jesus says about having your treasures in this world. There are thieves. They can come and steal it. Simple as that. But if God is sovereign and I'm praying, he can protect me. Yeah, he can. But he won't. Anytime a thief succeeds, that's by the will of God. God doesn't just wake up from a nap and say, what's been going on here? Why are all my children crying out to me? He's not like Baal. So he's seen that, and he doesn't see God in it. He sees the vanity of it. You just can't keep the money. And you can't succeed in getting the things you covet. The misery of the covetous man is a positive evil, he goes on to say in verses 3 to 6, that's worse than the negation of existence. Better for that man to have been aborted or stillborn, never to have lived, never to have seen the light of day, than to be covetous. Better. Do we think of covetous like that? It is an evil so great that it would be better if our own mothers had aborted us. But it is. It's a ruination. Why do men fight? Why do nations go to war? There's always something material involved in it. The man labors for self-fulfillment, and yet his desires only increase. Verse 7. All a man's labor is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is not satisfied. And in verses 3 to 6, the man's, again, death comes in there and spoils everything. The man is better if he didn't exist at all. Covetousness cuts across educational and economic lines. Verse 8, for what advantage does a wise man have over a fool? Meaning, if they both covet, then neither one of them are going to profit. What advantage does the poor man have knowing how to walk before the living? Well, nothing if he's coveting. You could be poor and covet. Such may be able more or less to control the desire or to conceal it from others, but they can't satisfy it. They can't satisfy it. If we covet things, we know we're not going to let that show to other people. It's just instinctive. We just don't do it. So only we know whether we're coveting. Nobody else can tell. That's what makes it such a dangerous thing, because nobody can help us. Nobody can say, I see that you're a covetous person. So the man should enjoy what he possesses and quit coveting. Verse 9. Easier said than done. Coveting is a power greater than man. And that's what this all comes down to. There is a power greater than man. Verse 10. Whatever exists has already been named. By whom, we ask? This is what I mean about studying this and thinking, where's the truth in this? What exists has already been named. Well, that leaves us an assignment. By whom? And it is known what man is. By whom? For he cannot dispute with him who is stronger than he. Who is this him that is stronger than he? These forces of loving money and coveting are certainly stronger than all of us. That's why the only way we could possibly succeed in resisting these things is by the very power of God in Christ in our lives. To have Christ as our treasure, not money. So, easier said than done. But is the greater force a force of evil? Soul-consuming covetousness, for example, is he talking about an evil? Is it named by evil? It's already been named. Covetousness is going to win. Covetousness knows. Covetousness is like it's personified. It's more powerful than anybody. Perhaps. Or is it good? Is he hinting again about God? The soul going out. We all have awareness of God. He's made that awareness through the things he's created. He's demonstrated that, shown us. We get busy, as before our conversion, doing it entirely, suppressing the truth of God and unrighteousness. We still do it as believers when we want something that we know we're not supposed to have. David wanted Bathsheba. He didn't run into the temple and pray an hour to God. Well, God, where's he? Go get that woman for me. You and I do the same thing. And we'd be much better people if we were more candid in admitting that to ourselves, if not to one another. That's why the Bible commends to us to confess our sins to one another so that we can help one another and be real and not just out on a pretty parade. Is it good? Who is to say what's good? Who's to say what's good for man? Who can tell what the future will bring? Who's to say what's good for men? That's why people like money and love money so easily. That's why I love money. Because, again, I want that milk. I put the money down. I get no argument, no blowback. I say what's good for me. So give me enough money to do the things I want to do. Is that who he's talking about? These questions are raised, but they're not answered here. We're left to ponder these things. For to such fundamental and vital questions of the meaning, source, duration, and destiny of human life, the natural man and the Christian, when he's not exercising faith, has no answer. You say, but we always know that it's God. Yes, but if we just say that with our lips and don't believe it with our hearts, we're dishonoring God. Nor does the professing believer have a vital and genuine answer, because the love of money can slowly, imperceptibly turn the God he or she professes into a relic, a useless relic, from whom distraction easily develops. That's why the prodigal son left the father. He didn't see what was there to be seen. He didn't see that when he was there, everything the father had was his. And he had the father. By having the father, everything. He wanted half of it, and away I go and I'll spend it better. That's why the rich fool built his barns. That's why Martha was not sitting at the feet of Jesus, but was up criticizing her sister. Because that's God talking. She was thinking about the bologna sandwiches not being made. The true answer to who knows what is good for us and what the present and future holds for us is not found merely in how we use or abuse our money. The rich young ruler had everything. He was rich, he had money. He was young, he had strength and health, physical strength and health. He was a ruler. He had a position of high power. He told people what to do. They didn't tell him what to do. He had everything. Everything under the sun. But no assurance of anything beyond that. So he comes to Jesus and says, "What must I do to inherit eternal life?" Which is a kind of a contradiction. If you inherit it, it comes to you. It's bequeathed to you by someone who's going to die or has died. You don't get something, you don't do something to earn it. Never mind that. He still was worried and distracted from his own highest good and lasting contentment and joy. He knew he had it all. He knew it was not enough. Why? Not because he was robbing God and offending God of his tithes and offerings. God doesn't need tithes and offerings as though he needs them. And he's getting hurt if he doesn't get them. The tax gatherers do. The government does. Don't pay your taxes. They come to get you and they mean business. Because if everybody didn't pay, who would support all of it? Bureaucrats. No, it's not about God giving because God is demanding that we give and do something. It's because he was slowly but surely smothering himself without God, without God. And therefore, Jesus tells him not, go and give an offering. Start tithing. And confess your sin to God that you haven't been giving him his due. God says in Malachi, if you're not paying the offerings, you're robbing God. Go confess that sin. Jesus didn't say anything like that. Negatively, he said, cough up the cash, all of it. Cough it up. Throw it up. Vomit it. Get rid of it like it's the worst poison, which it is and has become to you. There's no other cure. No other cure. If it's taken that deep a hold on you, you've got to get rid of all of it, not just some of it, not most of it, all of it. Give away, sell your things. But not just that, positively, give it to the needy, which is a manner of loving your neighbor. Oh, this is great news for this guy, isn't it? So I got to give up all my money. And, how are you going to have a poor man with no possessions to maintain his high position in the world? Like, I can't be a ruler anymore. They'll all see me as a loser, and they'll get rid of me. Give it up. Give it to the needy. These people may be needy because they're not working. They might be on social welfare or something. Give it. Never mind. Don't worry about who it is and what they're going to do with it. Give it. Love your neighbor. Positive number two, come follow me. This is what the preacher is starting to sense and to grasp and to communicate to us. Like the prodigal, not here, entangled in his foolish and false losses. Here in the far country, I'm boo-hooing, I've lost all my money. I'm going to stay here. What else can I do? No, not here, not where we are. Not one of us should leave today thinking, I ain't changing a bit of my life because of that sermon. Every one of us needs to change it in every way here. This applies in some way to all of us. Not here, entangled by my foolish, false losses, but with my Father, with my Father. How heavily have you leaned into your Father this week, this day? How heavily, how thoroughly have you depended upon him? How totally do you see him and treat him as the one thing necessary? The height and infinite measure of goodness. Loving money that we have or coveting what we don't have are features of sin. And sin, and this is written to believers, can easily entangle us if we don't lay it aside. We've got to be intentional about this. It doesn't just wither away, and you don't dodge the bullets. I've got to lay it aside. Take it off. It keeps coming back. Take it off. The way out. Turning to or returning to the one true and living God, whom to know through Christ, his Son, his only Son. Better get used to minimalist living, not great quantity, God didn't provide great quantity for our salvation. One man. One man. His man. His Christ. His anointed one. His Son. Only. His Son only. The one thing necessary. Know him. Meaning to know not just intellectually. I know I can conceive of $1 million. What good does it do me? I don't have it, do I? Know him as your precious vital possession. Know him and treat him as the one thing necessary is eternal life. And coming to him as our master, the way the prodigal remembered said, look, I'm going to go home. Being a slave in my father's household is better than this. Treat me as a slave. You be my master. I'll be your slave. Coming to him as our master, we'll be surprised by joy because we'll find him to be our Father who will ignore our foolish request, thinking it's necessary that we admit to bondage and say, make me your slave. He's our Father, our true and essential good, because he, the who in these questions, not money or things we covet, only he has loved us and given his Son for us and has become our joy and our peace. Amen.